Consumerism Radio. I'm joined by my co-host, Ron Bachman. Ron, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. The fall allergy is starting to get to everybody, huh?
It is getting to me big time.
Well, don't worry. You got Obamacare.
There you go.
You can sign up.
Yeah, how was trick-or-treating at the Bachman house last night?
We had a big crowd of folks. I think it was nice the rain held off, so it was good weather. And they just come down in droves. They come down and open up cars and station wagons and just unload all the kids, and they all come running up. So I give them all the stuff I don't really like to eat first, and I try to hold back the stuff that I want to eat.
And then save the rest of it.
Yeah. I don't have any kids now to go out and bring stuff back. You know, I've got all my kids are gone, so I'm just giving away.
Yeah, we had a big night at our home as well. But speaking of trick-or-treating, it seems to be more tricks with healthcare.gov than there is treat.
not so good these days, right? I mean, it looks like a real mess out there. I don't know how they're going to fix it.
It does, yeah. Looks like it's a lot more fundamental foundation problems than they...
That's what I take out of it, that, you know, I've dealt with a lot of technology issues in my career, and if you don't have the right foundation, it's called architecture.
Yeah,
you know, the technology architecture. It's like the foundation of a house. If you don't build a good foundation of the house, the rest of the house isn't going to last, and you can't sort of fix the squeaky floors and the cracking walls if your foundation is the real problem. If you change one thing, everything else changes in the whole system. So I don't see how they're going to fix it. I think you have to scrap the whole thing and try to start over with, but that would mean a real delay. I don't think the politicians are up to that.
No, I think that's right. And, you know, from my farm background, you can only use baling wire so much.
There you go.
To fix it. What about the FSA ruling yesterday? What's your feeling on that?
Well, you know, there's some I haven't been keeping up with all the details. Usually I've been involved with the legislation and regulation on most of this stuff, but I did see the reports coming out that the flexible spending arrangements, the FSAs, they're going to allow a $500 carryover.
Yeah.
Now, it seems as though it's $500 of whatever you have left over each year, but it wouldn't accumulate that I carry over $500 this year and then I get to carry over another $500 into an accumulating FSA account. That could be the case, right. But I didn't get that out of what was sent to me. So I'm going to have to dig into that a little bit more. But the idea is that FSAs now have a health FSAs anyway, have a limit of $2,500. So they put a cap on it when you could do more. So this is the way, I guess, the those industry lobbyists helped to change the Treasury Department. And I think it also drives on the point that I usually surprise people with when we talk about the different accounts that are available out there, the health savings account, the health reimbursement arrangements, and the flexible spending arrangements, that under FSAs, none of that use it or lose it was ever a legal requirement. That was always an interpretation of the IRS.
Right.
And so they have the ability to change that. Yeah. Now, historically, they have been very hesitant to change that. When I was working in that area in Washington trying to change and allow for more use of FSA dollars, I did convince them to carry it over for 3 months. And so instead of it being a use it or lose it as of the end of December 31st of a year, you got an extra 3 months to use those dollars and not lose them. But now they've actually allowed for a carryover of $500. And their logic on that is that I think somewhere like 90%+ of the carryover potential dollars that were lost were less than $500.
Yeah.
So it allows a little bit more choice and flexibility by individuals.
You know, I think if there's positive news and it really cuts across account-based plans, you know, we've got a show today that's going to talk about celebrating HSAs. I think that one positive outcome is account-based plans, FSA, HRAs, HSAs appear to be alive and well.
They do, and amazingly enough, there was really an intent, and it was vocalized by this administration to try to minimize, if not kill, the health savings accounts.
Right.
And the irony is, of course, many times whenever the government sets out to do, the opposite happens.
Yeah.
And fortunately, in my opinion, the opposite has happened. In fact, the most affordable plans, the plans that are in many ways most attractive, the bronze level plans that are the least expensive turn out to be the health savings account eligible plans.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see a real growth in that area if the government exchanges don't kick in. The private exchanges are going to wind up selling an awful lot of the account-based plans.
And in the private exchange environment, I mean, everything you read is that the insurers particularly are looking at how they put the most low-cost plans in there. You know,
well, and there's no requirement at this point, at least. There's no legal requirement except maybe Utah as a state, because they've had an exchange up for some time, that the products that you sell through private exchanges – don't have to be the same products or the same pricing as right. they're sold through the government right. exchanges. And we know that the government exchanges at this point seem to be signing up mostly Medicaid, so they're not even going into the private mm-hmm. coverages. They're qualifying for Medicaid because we had millions of people who qualified previously for Medicaid but didn't sign up. Now there's an easy way to do that, and right. there's a big promotion, so we're getting those. But the people that are signing up that actually, you know, on the first day they had, what, six in the first hour or two and a couple hundred by the end of the day, and, you know, they're anticipating millions if they ever get the 4, 5, 6 million that tried to get on and gave up if they ever come back. But the people who are going to sign up at this point is pretty clear. They're going to be very bad risk. There's going to be a lot of pent-up yeah. demand for health care coverages. They're going to be people who are heavy users, and that means the prices of those products are going to go even higher than the initial estimates. And what most people don't understand at this point, but we will see it very shortly, is that on January 1st of 2014, so a couple months away, every state and the existing federal high-risk pool goes out of business.
Yeah.
And those people will go into the exchanges.
They all go into public exchange, right?
Which means that yeah. we have the – and there's probably, you know, 300,000 to 400,000 people that are yeah. going to go into there, and it's going to absolutely swamp those exchange products with very high claim costs and very heavy users of health care. Some of them will get subsidies, some of them won't, but the cost that they generate against those insurance products is going to be very high, which means the insurance companies at their first opportunity, which may be a renewal, maybe an early renewal, will jack those prices up even higher. So people are going to be shocked with the sticker price on those.
Yeah, a lot of further discovery that we're going to have to wait and see what happens coming up, right?
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, you know, Nancy Pelosi, you gotta implement it before we can see what's in it. Well, now we're seeing what's in it, and it ain't pretty. And there's going to be a lot more problems as we go down the road that we haven't even anticipated. But it doesn't look very good right now.
But you know, the interesting part about if there's a positive too on the other side is that you know the law has really driven the private market to really move ahead and create a lot of innovation.
Absolutely.
And around major medical and you know and all the other services that we always talk about.
Well, and part of what we're talking about today with the 10th anniversary yeah. of the health savings accounts. I mean, that's a private market initiative. Yeah. We had a law passed in December of 2003, and products are actually starting to be sold on January 1st, 2014. So in less than a month, the private market was actually up and running and selling these products. A little different than 3.5 years of government involvement that can't get a website right, let alone the products and services that are available through any other opportunity that they try to give the public to buy things. It's a total mess. But the private market actually can move faster, is more opportunistic.
Yep.
They prepare for it. They test for it. The security and privacy is a major issue now with the government site. But the private market can actually move pretty fast. And they'll only release things when they actually can. If there's a need for a delay, they'll delay. The government should have delayed that October 1st. They didn't. And now they're suffering the consequences of it. And I don't think they understand marketing. They don't understand customers that are not going to go back after they've tried it and failed. They're not going to keep going back over and over and over again for months. But the private market has taken a product idea, the health savings account, and has really exploded that idea beyond expectations. Yep. So now at the 10th anniversary, it is worth celebrating that we have a very successful way of engaging people, of giving them some choices, getting them financially involved by allowing them to pay for health care with dollars that they own rather than through premiums that go to the insurance company. So they can control their costs, they can use them effectively, they can seek out the cheapest prices and the best quality of service, and they actually are empowered. So it's really been a remarkable change by the introduction of health savings accounts.
And we've got three leaders today that's going to give us an interesting perspective, not only historically, but to make the point present and then future outlook. But let's talk a little bit about kind of the other sister, HRAs.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of credit is actually giving to HRAs, paving the way for HSAs, you know, development and evolution and being here now as a viable solution. And HRAs are very much alive and well. And
absolutely.
And Ron, you've been around, I don't want to date you, been around a long time.
But I have.
You know, you were around at the beginning of HRAs. I mean, you know, give us kind of a brief historical and bring us up to date on the HRA as a viable option. And
well, as you know, as all this, you know, success is a thousand fathers, they say. But HRAs, the health reimbursement arrangements, is the one area where I am proudest of my involvement. I've been right in the middle of most all of this over the last 15, 20 years as they've been developing. But the health reimbursement arrangements actually was an idea I took personally to the White House. September of 2001, PricewaterhouseCoopers, where I was a partner, had been working with a couple of companies. The one probably got the most press is a company called Medtronic, and I think John Young was involved, and we'll talk about that as well later on the program. But they were going bankrupt, and they decided they had to do something about the health care costs. So lawyers at the time, including PwC lawyers, had said that, you know, the IRS really could make an interpretation of the law and allow this carryover of funds from one year to the next so that you didn't have to use it or lose it. And without getting into the weeds, these were sections 105 and 106 of the IRS code. And for 20 years, the IRS had been asked to interpret it this way, but they would not even give a private letter ruling. So we saw the marketplace actually saying, well, hey, forget that. I don't need a private letter ruling. I'm going bankrupt anyway. I'm going to interpret this. My lawyers say it's okay. I'm going to do it, and we'll sort of force the IRS to make a decision one way or the other. Tell us whether we're out of bounds here or not, but we're going to go ahead and do it anyway. So we saw it developing in the marketplace, and so Newt Gingrich, actually, of all people, I know very well, he took me to the White House, and we spoke with Mark McClellan, who at the time was Bush's chief health care policy advisor. And I went through this whole idea, and at the time we didn't call them health reimbursement arrangements. We called them personal care accounts.
Oh, really?
Because we didn't know the term.
Yeah.
We said, listen, you don't even need to pass new legislation. All you need to do is have your Treasury Department declare this interpretation of their own code, which they've refused to do for 20 years. And he looked at me and he said, you mean I don't have to go past Ted Kennedy to get this thing done? Because there's always that infighting in Congress. Yeah, yeah. I said, no, you really don't. You just get your own IRS. You control that. It's part of the administration.
Right.
And he said, great. He said, I'll have this done by the end of the year. Well, guess what? The next week, 9/11 disaster occurred. And they kind of got sidetracked. But on, I think it's June 26th of 2002, like 9 months later, the IRS actually made this interpretation that allowed for health reimbursement arrangements, and that's only 9 months. And in Washington, 9 months is like the speed of light anyway.
Yeah, it is.
So you can see how powerful the idea was. So that even with the big distraction and the disasters of 9/11, we got this legislation, not this regulation through within 9 months. And
yes,
it really started
to
the whole
legislation.
World.
It was
no legislation involved at all. Now, that's got some good and bad for some of the discussions we're going to have, and that people are looking at how do we use these exchanges and define contribution. Because there was no legislation, it was entirely regulation, it was very difficult to make this interpretation and feed it through prior precedents, because the IRS has to follow precedents. And in order to do that, technically, most people don't know or understand or maybe appreciate the impact of this. Technically, health reimbursements arrangements are health insurance plans. They're not savings accounts. They're not real bank accounts. They're actually health insurance plans as defined by the IRS under the code.
They're not a pass-through. They're not a –
Right. Yeah. So that's why in some ways it's very difficult to do a health reimbursement only by an employer who under the Affordable Care Act has to have all these unlimited benefits, because unlike health savings accounts, which are real bank accounts, just dollars, they're not a plan. HRAs are dollars, but they're both sort of in that bailiwick of being account-based plans, and really was the precursor to real dollars being put in somebody's bank account, the HSAs. Without the HRAs, I'm not, and the success of selling those,
right.
I'm not sure that the health savings accounts would have ultimately come into being. So it really was the foundation, and I get to tell my grandkids that's where I was,
in the middle
of it, you know, very proud of that.
The father of the HRAs, yeah. Well, listen, we're wrapping up this segment, and I'm sure we'll bring back that discussion as we weave it within the HSA discussion over the next three segments. So to our audience, stay tuned for the next segment of Healthcare Consumerism Radio.
This is Ron Bachman, Chairman of the Editorial Advisory Board for the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism. The IHC is a collaborative community for innovative health and benefit management solutions. If you're a stakeholder involved in any part of the healthcare system, you'll find the Institute the voice for healthcare consumerism. We invite you to see more about the organization at www.theihcc.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Hi, this is Brent Macy, Managing Director for the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism. If you're a solution provider in this marketplace, I'd like to talk to you more about our corporate membership program that will allow you to showcase your solutions in front of our audience who will be making decisions on what they're going to be putting in place surrounding their healthcare benefit packages in 2013 and beyond. Contact me at 770-296-7276 to learn more.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Hey, this is Doug Field along with my co-host Ron Bachman, and welcome back to Healthcare Consumerism Radio. As I stated on the first segment, you know, this is going to be the first of a two-part radio program series on celebrating the upcoming anniversary of health savings accounts. And, you know, what a great way to kick off the program than to have Mr. HSA himself on the program.
Really?
You know, joining us is Roy
great,
Rantham.
Great guy.
Who's founder of HSA Consulting Services. He was involved at the very beginning of HSAs in the Treasury Department, then went on to be health policy advisor for President Bush. And he's also a member of League of Leaders. We're very proud to have him speak at every forum event. Roy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, good to have you here, my friend. You know, we got 13 minutes for you to talk about the history and the present and the future of HSA. So, and I know that's one of your passions, and you've been very instrumental to where it is today. Kind of give us a quick run through of, you know, where we've come, where we are, and where you see us going.
Well, I have to say, you know, it was such an honor for me to be able to serve our country in this capacity, because I recognized what HSAs meant to healthcare financing as soon as I heard about them. I'd been familiar with the demonstration project prior to that. But, you know, for all the years of work that I had done and on the government and in the private sector, to me the HSA really puts the crux of how healthcare is financed back at the centerpiece of the conversation. Most of us have made so many assumptions about how much healthcare costs and how much we consume as a result, because we really don't have a stake in how much to pay for all of those things. We've made a lot of assumptions about what's covered by our insurance, and as a result, we end up, you know, consuming healthcare like it was free. So I was very excited to have the opportunity to really launch this program and watch it grow over the years to something that I think is really contributing to the recent decline in annual rates of increase in spending in healthcare, which for a small program, which is a small piece of the total puzzle here, I think is quite remarkable.
Yeah. It really is, Roy. It's Ron Bachman. How are you doing today?
Great.
The HSAs, when they were passed, give a little, you know, we're talking about, you know, celebrating this, but let's give us a little bit of background when it was passed, how it got passed, what it was a part of, and you were at the Treasury at the time writing the regulations, as I recall. Tell us a little bit about that time period and what was going on.
Well, most of the effort was focused on getting the Medicare prescription drug legislation passed. This was an issue that Senator Ted Kennedy and President Bush were very involved with and wanted to kind of make part of their legacy. HSAs were a key piece of actually getting the votes to make it pass, but most people weren't focused on the HSA provisions at the time. They were focused on the Medicare pieces, and it was sort of a historic crossroads, if you will, because there were a group of Republican members in the House of Representatives who were very concerned about adding a new entitlement program onto our federal budget. We hadn't had much success in controlling the cost of Medicare up to that point. What, you know, would make us think that we were going to do any better by adding a new benefit, especially an expensive one like prescription drugs. So it was really their insistence that HSAs be included in the legislation in order for them to vote for it. And it was that really sort of political opportunity, that compromise, that got us to where we are.
As I recall, And what you're saying, I think, to be clear for our audience out there, it was that the HSA enabling legislation was tacked onto the Medicare Modernization Act. So it's the way you get things done in Washington, right? You attach something to another bill.
Part of that sausage making process.
There you go. Now, another piece, again, the background on some of this so that people understand, we almost didn't get the HSA legislation and the Medicare modernization because normally at that time, as I recall again, that the process had been set up for 18 minutes for a vote, and they didn't have the votes at the end of 18 minutes. And they extended that vote, got all those Republicans who were concerned about all this, told them about, well, the real value is in the HSA piece that's being attached to it. And when they went back, maybe you recall more, I think they only passed by about 4 votes, didn't they?
It was very close. Yeah. It was sort of the part of the arm-twisting process, if you will. In order to get this legislation passed, even the president's support for the legislation was not enough for some of the Republican House members. So we've seen this happen before with other legislation. Mm-hmm. It happened with the Affordable Care Act in the House of Representatives, too, which squeaked by through a very tight margin. It is part of the political process. We have to recognize that sometimes that's how those things happen, mm-hmm. and sometimes they don't happen because the window of opportunity closes before they can secure the votes.
Now, you were at Treasury when that happened, and you actually had served, as I recall, over in the Congress, helping, was it in the Senate side or the House side?
Senate Finance Committee,
Finance Committee. Tell us about how that works when the bill is passed and it goes over to the Treasury. You've got this HSA legislation, which no legislation is entirely clear and straightforward. What did you do with it when you got it over to the regulatory side, over Treasury?
Well, the first thing we did was try to quickly put out a little bit more clarification and sort of summary of the major provisions. And we did that before the end of the year. So in less than a month, we got out some initial guidance to just help people understand the key pieces. Anytime you read legislation, you're not sure if you actually understand it. So we tried to organize it in a way that could be logical so that more lay people could understand what the HSA opportunity was. Then we called a big meeting of interested stakeholders, employers, banks, insurance companies, et cetera. And we met at the Treasury Department in mid-January and asked them to tell us what were the key decisions that we needed to make that would be most helpful to them in understanding how this legislation was supposed to work and how they could go out and create products. You know, what were the uncertainties that they had after we had done that description? And that shaped our guidance that came out in March. I think we put about 3 or 4 more things out in March, and then a larger package in July, so that by Labor Day, we had put out 8 pieces of guidance in, you know, 8 months' time. That is almost unheard of in the federal government.
A lot better than what's been going on with the regulations for 3.5 years under Obamacare and 10,000 pages. What I recall in that period of time, Roy, was that, you know, one of the real values of health savings accounts was 100% coverage for preventive care, because everybody's always worried about preventive care so that you didn't avoid preventive care services. But as I recall, there was a problem with the legislation on preventive care, and you had a pretty good load to identify what was allowed under preventive care 100% and what wasn't. Do you recall that piece, and can you tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, I recall it very well.
I figured you would.
The statute actually has a sort of mysterious reference
to a wrong area,
which made it very challenging to understand, well, what did they really intend to use as a definition for preventive care. The reference in the law doesn't go to a place in the Medicare law that's helpful in understanding what they meant. So the IRS then started looking for definitions of preventive care that might already be available that would be helpful to crafting a definition, and found the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is an arm of the Department of Health and Human Services, which analyzes all of the research on various medical services and then gives each preventive service a ranking. And it's based on evidence, clinical evidence, of how much do we actually know about whether this does, in fact, prevent anything. And I think they felt most, the IRS being, felt most comfortable with sort of a classic definition of preventive care. We're going to limit that to things before you're diagnosed with an illness or a condition or a disease, and what types of services prevent the onset of that disease. Now, there are a lot of
So you really helped, let me sort of jump in a little bit. You really helped to define the preventive care services that become so important in the whole wellness movement of healthcare consumerism is what you're really giving some of the background on. So really you started the whole process of being able to more clearly define even what's carried over into Obamacare now in the way they've gone to the same U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, right?
Exactly, and that was the foundation for how they defined it in the Affordable Care Act.
So let me move a little bit to you then moved from the Treasury over to the White House to become Bush's chief health care policy advisor. HSAs were so valuable. We haven't got that much time left, but a few minutes. But can you tell us how you began to form a national health reform program around health savings accounts? Because people say, well, there were no Republican ideas for national health reform. But in fact, you had one. The President Bush was using HSAs as the foundation for a potential national health reform, right?
He absolutely was. And in his budget proposals while I was there, we developed a number of proposals that would have expanded HSAs and tied that to the availability of financial assistance through tax credits to individuals who are buying insurance on their own and get no favorable tax treatment for the premiums that they pay. We know that that's a huge gap. Self-employed individuals don't get the same tax advantages that employees typically working for employers get, and so we tried to make HSAs the centerpiece of the expansion of health coverage in ways that were market-driven and market-based, but would give consumers the ability to take advantage of these opportunities and then even make the HSA account even more attractive where they could cover all of their out-of-pocket costs, not just their deductible, which had been sort of the model up to that point.
So with the with that whole concept, we and the success we're seeing with HSAs to control healthcare costs, we actually, if we had been able to move forward with that, we could have had what I might have called an HSA nation, right?
Yes.
And that would have dramatically changed everything.
And we argued very strongly to legislators that, you know, we know that health reform is a concern of many people. They don't have access to affordable health insurance. Right. This is a way that we can provide that to them and get ahead of the curve before, you know, those who advocate for a government-run solution to the problem gets legs. Well,
right.
We saw what's happened as a result.
Right. Right.
We didn't address the problem, and now we have the Affordable Care Act.
Right. Well, thanks for your input here, because I think we may actually get back to that at some point. Any last way for the people want to find out more about what you're doing and your continued involvement with HSAs? any final words in these last 20 seconds?
Well, you know, I've devoted my life to, since that point, to promoting HSAs and consumerism and healthcare, and the company that I founded is devoted to that, and so if you go to our website, HSAconsultingServices.com, you can find out more ways that we can help you. You can also go to my educational website, HSAED.com, where you can get answers to frequently asked questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Roy. I hate to cut you off.
We want everyone to have.
We got a hard stop. So thank you very much for your input. We'll have you back and even get into more of this and look forward to seeing you in Las Vegas for the big celebration party.
Thanks for including me on the show.
Thanks, Roy.
Hi, this is Brent Macy, Managing Director for the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism, and I'd like to invite you to come join us December 5th and 6th at the Red Rock Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada for IHC Forum West. At the event, you will be able to benefit from 5 leading general sessions and 24 informative workshops that talk about all the moving pieces to healthcare consumerism. If you haven't signed up, we urge you to sign up at theihcc.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Hi, this is Brent Macy, Managing Director for the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism. If you're a solution provider in this marketplace, I'd like to talk to you more about our corporate membership program that will allow you to showcase your solutions in front of our audience who will be making decisions on what they're going to be putting in place surrounding their healthcare benefit packages in 2013 and beyond. Contact me at 770-296-7276 to learn more.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hey, this is Doug Field along with my co-host Ron Bachman, and welcome back to this segment of Healthcare Consumerism Radio. We continue our dialogue around celebrating, 10th anniversary of HSAs, and certainly one individual that was at the forefront and at the foundation at the beginning of HSAs. In fact, she got involved with HSAs because of her family business. And so we welcome to this program Beverly Gossage with HSA Benefit Consulting. Beverly, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you with us. And I should tell our audience also that Beverly is a Republican candidate running for Insurance Commissioner of the state of Kansas. Congratulations on that and good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
You've got to be careful about that. You know, the past insurance commissioner wound up being governor and now is in the hot seat up in Washington as head of HHS.
I hope to change that pattern here in the land of Oz.
Well, if you follow that pattern, it would be good. You could be there. I'd like for you to follow that pattern, become governor, and then straighten out Washington for us.
Have no intention of becoming governor. Just want to fix the insurance department and work as a member of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, whom you may know had a huge influence in model legislation in Obamacare.
Right.
Yeah. Talk to us, Beverly. Give us a little historical perspective from your seat on the evolution of HSAs, and then bring us to today and what you see, moving forward.
Well, sure. Very quickly, as you mentioned, my family owns a plumbing company, 17 employees in Lawrence, Kansas. I was district manager for Sylvan Learning Center. And they had asked if I could help them do some research to figure out what they were going to do with these 27% annual increases that they kept experiencing. And so in my research, I found medical savings account plans, and my sister as an accountant thought it was a great idea as well. But when I called the Department of Insurance, they said, MSA, what? Well, I don't know what that is, and you may want to call the insurance carriers. We don't know what products they offer. So that started me on this journey, and as I began to contact these carriers, and this was December of 2012, by the way, when I began contacting the carriers, I found 2, Starmark and Assurant, that would offer these policies, but they'd never really done a group plan. They'd done a few self-employed people. As you know, MSAs were the precursor to HSAs, and they were temporary. So it was like a one-year legislation that continually said, well, we'll renew that for another year. So a lot of carriers didn't pick up on it. Who wants to go to a lot of trouble creating products for something that may go away in a year? So I did talk to them about possibly doing a group plan for my family's company. They were open to the idea, had no agents that really specialized in that. That was really it for me. I saw this as a new mission as an educator. I needed to help others like my family's company find out why they're paying way too much to the insurance company and put more money in their own pocket and be better consumers. So I got my license, helped my family's company, found out later, to, as far as I know, they are the first full replacement group MSA, now HSA, in the country. So shortly after Castle Plumbing had this policy, I started looking at all those restrictions, and, there wasn't much available to read about MSAs. I found Ron Bachman, and Ron, I know you're on this call, and you're one of my heroes in the consumer driven healthcare
that.
World.
He's one of ours too, Beverly. Okay?
Careful, my head's getting too big.
And Michael Cannon and John Goodman and some of the others that had papers out there, Regina Herzlinger, I began reading some of their papers, their blogs, et cetera, not much, but some, about MSAs, and started talking about how we could take off some of the restrictions and some that concerned me for my family's company. However, kind of overnight, I became this MSA expert, if you will, and was asked to speak at the local chamber, Kansas Chamber, NFIB, FDA. And as I would call the Department of Treasury, they would always connect me to Roy. And that's how we became friends. And I would ask about clarification. We talked about the law, talked with folks at Luminos about, now there's this possibility we could take off some of these restrictions, go from MSAs to HSAs. I was so excited about the idea. So what could I do to help? When this law was finally passed, threw a big celebration, yay, contacted all my clients who were waiting in the wings who wanted an HSA the moment it was passed. So January 1st, I started flooding all these applications in for people who had not self-insured or not necessarily a small group, couldn't wait for an HSA-qualified plan. About March, I got a phone call, and the phone call from, actually it was a fax from Assurance Health saying, Beverly, please stop. Quit sending in all these applications. This hasn't been approved in Kansas. I went, what are you talking about? It's a federal law. Yeah, but see, they have to approve it, so they're saying they don't have the tax advantage there, so we can't write these yet. I said, wait a minute. These people have accounts for 3 months. So I contacted the Department of Insurance. They said, we don't know much about this. You should call this person who might be in charge of that new law possibility. So I said, what can I do? They said, can you testify tomorrow? So that began this long line of testifying, of course, not only in Kansas but elsewhere, about why we needed to go from MSAs to HSAs. So it's kind of this history of how I became involved. I have been an agent now since December of 2012. I've yet to write a policy that was not HSA qualified. Mm-hmm. It just makes sense.
And Beverly, you really raise another concept which we hadn't talked about so far, and that is MSAs. You know, in any industry, you have all these letters, these alphabet soup descriptions, and we haven't talked about MSAs. So you've actually taken us before the beginning of the legislative history that we talked about with Roy on health savings accounts, and I think it's really important that you bring that up because in 1997, there was legislation passed on something called medical savings accounts, which was a compromise with Senator Ted Kennedy's interest in not having this and Newt Gingrich's interest, who was Speaker at the time, of having some sort of an account-based plan. And the driving force, and if you go to the what I would call the headwaters of the Nile as to who really started this thing rolling, it was a fellow named Pat Rooney, who is no longer with us. Yeah. He passed away a number of years ago, and he was Chairman, CEO of Golden Rule, which was the really strong proponent of medical savings accounts. Yeah. They were selling to individuals. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in this celebration, I'd mentioned that as we were talking about people getting their insights. And I said, well, the real person it'd be great to have is Pat Rooney. And unfortunately, he's not here. So I don't know if we're going to be able to get somebody from Golden Rule to input to this historical perspective. But the fact that you were
what's
out there.
What's rather sad is here is Golden Rule, who's one of the pioneers, of course, of these plans. Mm-hmm. And I just discovered that they are going, that they, as of January 1, will stop offering individual private policies in Kansas.
Yeah, that's
so that ends those who want HSAs from them. And that is eliminating much of the competition that's been available through Obamacare.
Well, when you become
another story.
When you become insurance commissioner, invite me out. I've got a whole lot of good ideas to make Kansas an HSA state in spite of the limitations of the Obamacare.
That is my goal.
All right.
We've had some legislation that I pioneered that has gotten passed here. We now have HSAs available to state employees. So we are certainly working on that.
That's great. Now, where do you see some of this going in terms of the ability for HSAs to be sold under the Obamacare restrictions, legislation, and regulations?
Well, I could use Kansas as an example. Everybody wants to talk about the exchange, of course. Mm-hmm. I started about 3.5 years ago working with now Commissioner Sandy Prager, who is, by the way, Kathleen Sebelius' best friend. That's all you need to know about that. And she was really wanting to implement this and be an early innovator. and implementing an exchange in Kansas. I wrote a paper that was placed on Americans for Prosperity's website about why we did not want to be an innovator, especially with the conflict of the fact that we were part of the 26 states lawsuit against this, and gave all the reasons why. Thankfully, Sam Brownback, Jeff Collier both listened and returned that innovator grant money. I say that to say this. So we have a federal exchange. In the federal exchange, if you could get on to buy a policy, which is wink, wink, there you would find there were two carriers available. That would be Coventry and Blue Cross. Both of them offer one HSA-qualified plan. That plan is a $6,300 deductible. Well, I have people asking me all the time for even larger deductibles because of the limitations put on the deductible by HSAs. Mm-hmm. They said, why can't I have a $10,000 deductible and still have an account? Why are they limiting that? We can talk about that in a moment. However, just to give you a perfect example, I've spent several days doing research running actual quotes. If you were to buy a policy today on the open market in Kansas and then you were to buy one in the exchange, you would discover that you can currently get a $5,000 deductible HSA qualified plan, very popular, through the same carrier with the same providers, and find that your premium, I'm going to use a 27-year-old, which is what they use as an example for the exchange, and their premium would be about $48 to $52 a month. Mm-hmm. Now, due to Obamacare and some of the preventive wellness, the presentations that they put in it, it moved it up to about $60 a month for December 1. However, January 1, that moves up to $136 a month. Hmm. And you go from a $5,000 deductible to a $6,300 deductible.
Hmm. Does Kansas have a high-risk pool?
Kansas does have a high-risk pool. We have about 2,800 people in that high-risk pool. It was working very effectively. Kansas has some of the lowest rates in the country, and part of the reason is because we still have an active risk rating with an unlimited ratio. For your listeners, of course, that what that means is that Obamacare has implemented a 3-to-1 ratio of the 20-year-old up to the 64-year-old, and that the differentiation between that those two stratas will be 3-to-1. Mm-hmm. Well, now in Kansas, there is no determination. That can be 100-to-1. Mm-hmm. So you see people who are very young who have $48 premiums for their $5,000 deductible. However, I wrote one for a 63-year-old a couple of days ago, and this was for her policy that would have started today for November 1st for $168 a month. Mm-hmm. We have had wonderful low insurance policies here because we, number one, do not require normal maternity. We only have 46 mandates compared to 72 in some states. In fact, I helped to write a law called HB 2107 we passed last year, which is a mandate light bill that carriers could offer policies that do not include any of the mandates required as long as they indicate which mandates are not included. Of course, carriers are saying, great, thank you, but our hands are tied because Obamacare says all policies must include this.
Hey, Beverly, this is Doug. We really appreciate you being on this segment, and we've got about a minute to go, and I want to give you a chance to give our audience, you know, some clear takeaways that you'd like to leave them with.
Well, one of the things is that they may not know only 11 insurance commissioners are elected in this country. The rest are appointed. So I would appreciate help with www.beverlygossage.com, anything that you could do to help us, because as a free market person, and of course I believe in consumer-driven health care, being a voice on the National Association of Insurance Commissioners with federal legislation that affects all of us is extremely important, and I want to lead that way, as you said, make Kansas an HSA state. Absolutely.
Thank you, Beverly, very much, and we'll see you out west in Las Vegas. We look forward to that.
Can't wait to see you all. Thank you.
Take care. To our audience, stay tuned for the final segment of Healthcare Consumerism Radio.
Healthcare Consumerism Radio. Learn, connect, share. Join us every Friday at 11 o'clock to learn all those confusing issues around healthcare, Obamacare, Medicare, Medicaid. We'll help you find the answers, help you stay in compliance. Join us Friday at 11 o'clock.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Hi, this is Brent Macy, Managing Director for the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism. If you're a solution provider in this marketplace, I'd like to talk to you more about our corporate membership program that will allow you to showcase your solutions in front of our audience who will be making decisions on what they're going to be putting in place surrounding their healthcare benefit packages in 2013 and beyond. Contact me at 770-296-7276 to learn more.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hey, this is Doug Field along with my co-host Ron Bachman, and welcome back to the final segment, Healthcare Consumerism Radio, and our continuing discussion on HSAs, the celebration of the 10th anniversary. Look back, present day.
Happy birthday.
Look ahead. Yeah. And we can't have this discussion without having our next guest involved. Not only is he a friend of the Institute, a member of the League of Leaders, and actually last year's J.R. Robbins Leadership Award winner. He was involved at the beginning of Consumer Driven with Definity. He went on to be Senior VP of Consumer Driven or of Consumerism at Cigna, where we got to know him. And he's currently has his own company, Consumer Driven LLC. And welcome to the program, Mr. John Young. John, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good, my friend. Good to have you here. If you've been following some of the dialogue, you know, kind of pick up and kind of give us your view on, you know, the beginning and where we are today and where, you know, where you see it going.
I'm happy to. Just thrilled to be with you guys this morning. It was great to listen to Roy and Bev's perspectives, and I was out in the field trying to get people to embrace this new idea. So I went through a lot of shoe leather in the early days, and this was not for anyone who fears rejection, let me tell you, because innovators that would embrace this type of thing were few and far between, and then once in a while you would find the believer. Mm-hmm. Or some really well-leveraged HR person who knew how to get the senior leadership team to agree. But we did a lot of C-suite training. We did a lot of broker training on this new idea. And this is the first HRA plan was Medtronic. You mentioned that, Ron, and it was October 1st, 1999. So a lot of the of 1999 and 2000 was quite a bit of walking into offices and trying to get people for that light to turn on, that idea that the way we're doing employee benefits is lunacy, and that what we needed to do was turn it into the hands of normal people, and with the proper financial incentives, they would make different decisions, and then. You know, Viola, once in a while you would get someone to start to embrace. So it was a slow going. And, you know, where the most interest was in the jumbo firms, because they almost have like some built-in innovation within their benefit staff. They want to be fresh. They want to do the new thing. And then the small organizations were, you know, the guy we're talking to or the gal we're talking to was the CEO and HR person all rolled into one, and they were an entrepreneur, and they understood the value of that kind of financial risk in their own business, and they wanted their employees to share that as well with benefits. And it was the mid-market that was the slowest to respond. And there's a lot of inertia in the middle market, but the early days was a lot of a lot of work, let me tell you.
A lot of heavy lifting, right?
You know, yes.
John, it's really a testament to how the free market works, that there were people like you that were out there trying to explain and promote the products. We didn't need the government, you know, hiring navigators to try to explain, set up their own websites. You made it work. But, you know, one of the things about, you know, and our paths have crossed for so many years in all this, one of the things that may be fascinating for our audience to hear a little bit about is you worked for companies that both embraced the account-based plans and for a company that didn't. When you worked for Great West, they were not as aggressive in the marketplace as, say, Cigna was when you worked with them, and
right.
They didn't quite match up with your interest. Tell us what happened to a company that didn't have the foresight to get into this market and take advantage of these new approaches. What happened in that environment?
Well, I think John Maxwell once said something like, everything rises and falls on leadership. It's all about leadership.
Right.
And the leader at the time at Great West, I think he said this to you, Ron. I mean, I remember you telling me this, that he said to you something like, consumers don't want to be driven. They want to be chauffeured.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. And we won't mention who that was.
Right. But you know what? He was spot on right. I mean, if we take a look at our feet or behind us, we're going to develop different types of, you know, solutions for people. But if we look ahead and say, okay, what is really best for the corporation, for the individual, for this country, we have a completely different set of eyes. And at the time, that organization believed in a modified type of consumerism plan that still had copays, but tried to get people to be a little bit more savvy and prudent in the outpatient area and some labs and X-rays where the thinking was people had more time to make different decisions, but they were not embracing account-based plans. And I had that, like, I had Nikita Khrushchev moments with the senior leadership team. I stood up on a chair. At that time, I think I weighed 310 pounds, so I think it's pretty dramatic. Organizations that have leaders that believe make the difference.
Well, and that's organizations true of those customers you're trying to get. The companies that had the leaders that had the foresight to see the value of this were those early adopters that
absolutely
you're able to get into. And, you know, following that same example we were talking about with, whether they want to drive or be chauffeured, I think the real parallel to the account-based plans is you'll more effectively use that taxi or that limousine if you're paying the taxi driver as opposed to somebody else paying the taxi driver, and you'll get to where you want to go more rapidly.
Yeah, well put.
So ultimately that company, as I recall, sold off their group business. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, they were acquired by Cigna.
Yes,
so they got out of the business and they sold their client base to a company that wanted to implement the kind of consumerism we're talking about. So, I mean, that's, again, the power of the marketplace. Different companies get to make different strategic choices, and you're going to have winners and losers. The companies that don't look into the future find a way things are going to be more effectively delivered, better products, better choices, better options, lose out, and other companies that embrace that future and make good choices for their clients and develop products are going to be winners. So as we begin to move forward, tell us about where you are today in your enthusiasm around health savings accounts.
Oh, I think today is we're well into the early adoption of HSAs, and, you know, a lot of people might just wrinkle their nose at that because, you know, only 7% of Americans have these. They're covered. Americans have HSAs. The Mercer's report last year showed 16% of people in account-based plans, which doesn't sound like a success, and frankly, it isn't. It's a failure because these things we've known for so long how that these things in fact work and are awesome at controlling costs and improving health. You know, there should be 8 out of 10 people in these plans, right? So, but here we are. We're at this place where this is becoming more and more popular. I think we are right at the precipice of a Diet Coke Mentos moment. We add exchanges and HSAs, and boom. What we're seeing with the private exchange experience is that people, for the most part, two-thirds in one study from Bloom Health, showed that people were self-selecting down in benefits as far as value. So they were self-selecting higher cost share because it cost them less. But it was in their control. They made that decision because of a defined contribution strategy. And of all of those people that did this, more than half bought an HSA-qualified plan. So if you just give an HSA in the normal way of doing things in the past, was bringing an HSA in as an option, maybe replacing a popular plan, bringing an HSA as an option. Very few, but an increasing number, are doing full replacement types of strategies, but it was normally brought as an option. You would get 10, 15, 20%, and I honestly, 20%, 25% was considered a huge success from the employers that brought that strategy in. Now, imagine if we can have kind of a view of what exchange activity is going to be from what these private exchange experiences have been. It's you know, more. This is going to supersize HSA adoption. You know, one out of two people are going to self-select lower benefits with HSA-qualified structure. And now the industry needs to step up, help the, you know, the problem, as you all know, is most of us are pretty illiterate when it comes to the healthcare system, our healthcare plan, HSAs, how it works. But not just getting people enrolled in these plans, we have to put a lot of attention on the customer to make sure they understand the value of the HSA when these new high cost share arrangements that these people have embraced.
Well, you know, and with your enthusiasm, you know, like us, you'd love to see everybody with an HSA. So the reality of some of the numbers is that it's grown very rapidly. It's grown faster than 401ks when they were introduced. We now have from some of the surveys, more than 66%, two-thirds of companies offer an HSA as an option. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more and more full replacements, right, as you're talking about. So I think we have seen tremendous success with HSAs and account-based plans, and we're at the precipice where there's no more question about the value. There was years where people were questioning the value. Has it really changed behaviors? Is it just cost shifting? And that all has been put to rest, and people are getting better services, better options, better choices. And we're now moving into an incentive program that is based upon real outcomes and not just participating in programs. So we're driving the behaviors even more strongly. So I think you're right. We're at that sort of precipice where with even the rapid growth we've had of people signing up, of having it available, I think we're about to see an explosion, even under Obamacare, which actually these become the most affordable products available. So it's going to be interesting to
see.
Yeah.
Hey, John, this is Doug. We've got about a minute to go. I mean, time flies when we're having fun here talking about HSAs and healthcare consumerism. So leave our audience with a couple takeaways that you'd like to leave for them, please.
I would tell every stakeholder out there listening to do whatever you can to fight for this innovation to take hold in employers, with individuals, within exchanges, to work to make that customer experience better. Because, you know, CDHPs were built really by persistent believers and innovative employers and brokers, and we need that even more today. That kind of enthusiasm and spirit to help this along in its natural course. I think HSAs are a phenomenal way to get people to care about consumption, and it's a perfect financial vehicle for these participants, whether they're savers or spenders. And I think these exchanges are going to show huge expansion in these HSAs. What I would call for is more believers, more people pushing this strategy, and really focusing on the customer experience so that the individual understands and appreciates and know how to use their HSA. The growth is enormous. It's 29% a year in accounts and account growth. It's going to get even more.
John, thank you again so much for spending time with us. You know, our audience, you can continue this discussion with John at IHC Forum West in Las Vegas, December 5th and 6th. John, have a great weekend.
Yeah, you guys too. And good talking to you.
Thanks. And to our audience, stay tuned for continuing discussion next week on celebrating the 10-year anniversary of HSAs. Have a good weekend.